He took a sip of the ale before he answered. A nut brown color it was, thick on the tongue, the way he liked it. "Aye," he said, "I mean to be a champion." Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it was best to rename and rebrand ourselves as the game did so with a second edition. Now, we are the White Book Podcast, and each week we bring you your dose of strategy, insight, and all-around geeky goodness. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, but more importantly to you, our listeners. Please consider supporting us on Patreon so that we can continue to make this show the best it can, and I promise we have big plans for the future. This is The White Book. I've finally given up, and I've decided, you know what, Martin's never actually putting out any other books in the actual Song of Ice and Fire, so I'm going to start using quotes from all the other random stuff he's put out. I'm no longer keeping myself just to the novels, so there we go. That's from The Hedge Knight.
Boom.
Yeah.
I like the nut browns and thick on the tongue. Those are good visions.
I mean, I figured it combines two very important things from this past weekend, right? Drinking and becoming the champion.
I was like, three of us did one of those things, and one of us did the other thing.
Well, you know, we tried. I reached out to Leonard. I haven't heard back yet. Maybe we can get a champ on. We'll see.
He's probably still traveling.
Yeah, very possible. I didn't necessarily expect a quick response from him in order to get him in on this night that we're recording now, which is literally like right after Worlds. So, okay, so in this episode, the final episode of Season 10, we're recapping Worlds, and it's going to wind up being in three segments thanks to kind of recording and scheduling issues here. So, We're going to have a bit first with myself and King of Swiss and would-be overall champion, if they still had it, James Walmsley. Then we're going to have a segment with myself, Kyle, Tyler, who was our Gen Con North American champion, as well as Matt Lay, often known as Rings, who was the other King of Swiss for Worlds, as well as Kyle Vansel. And then we're going to wrap with just myself, Tyler, and Kyle. So enjoy the episode, guys. Okay, so we've got an extra little segment here as a bit of a treat with myself and a guest host. Many of you may actually recognize him from, a wide variety of things. Formerly the Card Game DB comments areas, now Facebook, now his own podcast known as Listener Questions. You're just all over the place, James.
Yeah, it's nice to have a community that can tolerate me in large quantities.
Well, and even larger quantities now, unless I'm misremembering, we've never actually had you on the White Book before, have we?
I think I was on one episode like a good couple of years ago now. Like I think it was the episode where Gregor had just been spoiled, and I have vague memories of us dismissing him as being a 7-cost monocom with an ability that won't fire off that often. and sort of saying he was rubbish.
Man, you know, I'm noticing a real theme in White Book discussions lately, in that we keep coming back to, let's say, maybe misrating, misinterpreting, just in general, missing the mark on cards early on. So maybe we need to do a re-review episode at some point.
I mean, I guess it's just partly that no one's going to bring up all the times you were completely right, are they?
Exactly. That's just expected. No one really cares about that.
Yeah. Much more fun to bring up the times when Gaston Gray gets panned, or when some idiot gives left and right a 1 out of 5, or that sort of thing.
Oh, man. Good times. Never going to let that Gaston Gray bit go, are you?
as indeed we shouldn't. You should have foreseen that they were going to print a bunch of cards that made it busted good.
You know, my track record would be a lot better if I could see the future.
Yeah.
I'm going to get to work on that. I need a new crystal ball.
I'm worried mine would probably get worse somehow.
I don't know. I think you've got a pretty good tracker record, at least on reading the meta right now. I mean, the part of the reason you're on here for what will wind up being our World's Recap episode is a pretty phenomenal showing there, right?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it wasn't really that much reading the meta. Like, I think I said to you, because you asked me beforehand what I was planning on playing, I was like, mm-hmm. I don't know, any number of things could win. I'm just playing this because I like it.
Well, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for playing what you like and what you know. I think that there's definitely, shall we say, a common thread in popular and well-performing deck lists I've seen you publish in recent months on ThronesDB. I'm actually going to abuse a quirk of the White Book recording and release schedule today to tie next week's episode that was recorded last week into this, because we're actually spending some time discussing the cohort agenda, which of course you had the Northampton regional list was a cohort list.
Yeah.
And I seem to feel that there's kind of a common through thread here in that deck and your world's deck. Do you also think so?
I mean,
was it intentional, or am I reading too much into things?
They're both start decks that let you search your deck for like fun stuff, I guess. Is that what we're getting at, or is there something more that I'm missing?
No. I mean, in the broad strokes, that is kind of what I'm thinking about here. Like, was it actually any sort of evolution in building, or was this a total, you know, ground up new build that just happened to play out similarly?
It was a total ground up one, to be honest. It was basically like a month or two before Worlds, my planned deck was actually going to be an adaptation of my Euros deck, the Tyrell Wars.
Okay.
I was going to move it from being Wars to Come to being House of the Red Door High Garden. Mm-hmm. Basically, the logic being that since I'd won Euros, the meta had gotten a lot more quick. And that rather than playing to have more choice on rounds 4 and 5, it was better to play an agenda that let you control what your opponent could do a bit better from round one. And then FFG went and released a restricted list that kind of threw a spanner in those works by restricting 3 of the key cards for the deck.
Go figure.
So then after that, I was kind of torn between the Stark, which was basically built from, I'm in a chat where, you know, I'm just in a deck building chat. It's the ukulele chat. It's a few Brits. And we were talking about Skagos, and a couple of people were not sure how good it was. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to build a deck that's just designed to be as silly with Skagos as possible. And that first list was basically like a caricature of a deck. So it had, you know, both the core and Wolves versions of Eddard Stark. It had multiple brands. It had Fat Cat, but still only one copy. But then also three River Run Minstrels and two River Runs. And just, it was all over the place as far as the deck goes. And then I showed it, and like, we had a few games, and a couple of times it went off and looked really cool, but then a lot of the times it just sort of fell on its ass. And we thought it might be, there might be something there, but we'd have to spend some time refining it. So I kind of just sort of gave that list to a few people and was like, whatever, you know, have fun refining it. That'll be fun. In the meantime, people have just announced this interaction between Pinch of Powder and Raider from Pike. So I'm going to look at that. And I spent the next two or three weeks, I guess, just basically solidly building and playing a Greyjoy Fealty list. And that was really cool. I liked that a lot. And I gave the list to Issian. He made a few changes to it and took it to an event in the UK called the Siege of Winterfell, where he was King of Swiss and then won the whole tournament. And I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, this Greyjoy deck, it's really good. That's definitely what I'm going to be playing at Worlds. And then...
okay.
Then this was maybe a week or so before Keb and I were flying out to America. And then one of the people I'd given the Stark deck to was like, well, this Stark deck you gave me, there was a cool idea behind it. We've changed a few cards, and now it just keeps winning. And so I looked at that list, and that was fairly similar to where I ended up. It had a few changes that I still had to make to it, but I was like, okay, this is interesting. I'll take that. I'll tweak it to be more my play style a bit. I'll take it to a London meetup, see how that goes. And it's not so much that it won every game at the meetup, but it was more that it was so much fun. Like, as far as decks that I like go, it tends to be ones with all sorts of weird triggers and tricks. And Skagos has a billion different triggers and tricks you can do with it.
It really seems like it. I was seeing some comments from people about some very interesting and intricate plays that it afforded you, particularly with some cool interactions with Fleabottom and changing versions of Arya and such.
Yeah. I think across Worlds, I used most of those tricks. But yeah, so out of the Stark and the Greyjoy, I decided both of them were very good decks, but Stark just had more fun stuff you could do with it. So I took the Stark. My good friend Joe took the Greyjoy, and he ended up going 5-1 on day 1A, and then had an unfortunate loss in the top 32 to Neil Kimble, who went on to make top 8. So the Greyjoy deck was definitely very good too. Although I am definitely glad that I took the Stark, both because it was really good fun and obviously served me well, but also because there were so many people who seemed to have teched specifically to beat Greyjoy.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks are really expecting a bigger upswing in Greyjoy, and everyone kind of tried to out-counter that counter, and things did not shape up.
Yeah. I think people sort of looked at the top three factions going into Worlds as being Targaryen, Stark, and Greyjoy, and then they looked at those three factions and thought, well, Targaryen really is quite difficult to counter effectively, at least with decks that are actually good. Stark, likewise, like, you can sort of play a fairly honest game against Stark and just sort of see how it goes, but there's not too much in the way of, oh, well, this hard counters Stark. Whereas Greyjoy is a lot easier to tweak your deck to beat, I think. So, for example, with the Raider from Pike, just running lots of Nightmares, trying to run some more hand destruction, because Greyjoy obviously lacks for draw, running Valor to Harris as your reset, that sort of thing. And I think Greyjoy really suffered in a way that Stark and Targaryen didn't.
Yeah. So taking a look at that performance, I mean, here I am putting you on the predictive spot so we can come back to it later when you're terribly, terribly wrong. But we have another huge tournament coming up the weekend that this podcast goes live. You know, hot on the heels of Worlds, we come to what is certain to remain the largest Thrones tournament in the world at Stalag. So I'm kind of curious, do you think the lessons that we saw play out in Worlds still hold true for Stalik, or is this going to cause another counter correction so soon? Or, you know, what are you feeling?
That's a good question. This is going out.
This will be up on the 16th.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the day of the melee, and then Saturday will be the joust. So for me, the most likely deck to win probably is going to be Targaryen, either trading with Cahor or Assault from the Shadows. And the reason why I say those is because, first of all, with Assault from the Shadows, with Hizdahr, Hizdahr is already obviously an amazing card, and Assault makes him significantly more amazing. Because you can put, I don't know, like say Second Sons in the Shadows for free with your faction Neil, and then you can trigger Hizdahr, discard whatever you want to bring Second Sons out for free as a surprise defender. Or you can wait until your opponent has already knelt out in their challenges, then discard something with Hizdahr, bring out Khal Drogo for 3 gold, and then just butcher them with military. Or any number of other tricks like that. And then with Cahor, I think Gifts from the Widow from Chapter Pack 6 is going to be really important for them. So basically, I guess my answer is just Targaryen, because they are objectively the best faction right now. And then spicy new stuff, because people won't have teched for it in the way that maybe Red Dawn Marine, which was one of the, I think it was actually the joint highest performing faction agenda combo in Worlds. I think people can tech for that a bit easier, because you can run your Frozen Solids and your Lords of Port Shipwrights and, you know, all sorts of stuff to neutralize Marine in a way that you really can't with some of the newer stuff. So that's my prediction. And if I have to go with a secondary, this deck will surprise people choice, I'm going to say that Baratheon will do disproportionately well. I don't know if it will quite win. I don't know if I'll go that far.
I'm very intrigued by that. You think some of the existing tools that they've been getting over the last several months, or a specific boost from Assault or Banish from the Light or something very specific in this last pack?
I mean, kind of a mixture of both, I guess. So if we look at Worlds, Baratheon barely got played, but got 2 decks to the top 16, and 2 very different decks at that. We had a Barra Alliance Goat Rose, and we had a Barra Wolf, and both of them did really well. And there were only 4 Baratheon decks in the entire field, so for 2 of them to make the top 16 is very impressive. I think the degree to which Baratheon is rubbish has been overstated, in that people focus on, you know, the bad cards that Barra get, and they do get a disproportionate number, I think, of really bad cards. And I get why, as a Barra loyalist, you would focus on those bad cards. But Baratheon definitely have enough cards that you can build good decks. And at that point, you know, if you're getting, to use the white book grading scale, if you're getting like a C- or a D+ card that's not seeing play, or you're getting an F card that's not seeing play, it really doesn't matter at that point if it's not seeing play in the competitive decks. And meanwhile, I think Baratheon have just as many good, you know, B+, like A cards as any other faction does, really. Maybe not as many like bonkers S tier ones, but certainly enough that you can build a good deck. Like if you look at the unique characters they've received over the last 6 months or so, you've got Red Ronnet, Courtney Penrose, Justin Massey, Bastard Nightsong, like even the 3-cost Shireen Baratheon. They're all really good cards in that mid-range bracket, and it's done a lot to smooth out Barra's curve. And then when you throw in Banish from the Light and the fun tricks you can play with that to upset people, which is my main way of playing this game, I think Barra can do something. I was actually, right now I'm 50-50 on what I'm actually playing at Starlick. So I was going to be playing Tyrell Assault from the Shadows, like 1000%. That's what I was going to be playing the moment that we found out that Chapter Pack 6 was going to be legal for Starlick. but literally as of last night, it's now 50-50 between that and a Barrow-faced Militant deck. Basically, the idea of that one being High Sparrow and Banished from the Light can be really mean in combination.
Okay. All right. Banish things and then hamper their ability to ever bring them back out of shadows.
Yeah. And but you can run Barring the Gates because you're not really running any Enters Play tech yourself. You've got, you know, like Begging Brothers, which are really, really good in a meta that's filled with Hisdar and Drogon and Wyman Mandley and Rob Stark and all these cards. You can run quite low curve, so you don't really care so much about stuff like Pinch of Powder. And it just feels like a really good meta call. Whether it is or not, I don't know. But maybe by the time people are actually listening to this, I'll have gone, you know, 3-5 with it or something.
Well, I am actually rather intrigued to see if you do go that direction, how it goes. I find it interesting that when you mention that deck and also the Alliance build that made it into the top 16 at Worlds, I feel like those are decks that border onto the old false banner sort of perspective. I mean, yeah, nominally they've got the Baratheon House card, but those are decks that rely very heavily on the non-Baratheon stuff to make that come together. So I don't know, to some extent that makes me question how good Baratheon as a across the board faction has gotten, or if they just support better.
That's fair. I can definitely see how for some people it's not like true Barra, and I wouldn't necessarily dispute that. But I think that in both those decks, there's a reason why they're being played out of Baratheon first and foremost. Like for the Faith Militant Barra, you've got the Banish from the Light, you've got the Econ location that goes really well out of Faith Militant. It's about the only deck it does go really well out of. And with that Alliance Rose Cahor, really the card that makes that entire deck sing is the King of the Wall attachment, which again is a loyal Baratheon card. So it, you know, I feel like I completely get how people would not be thrilled with that as the definition of a Barra deck, but at the same time, you know, if it's House Baratheon, then I think there's only a certain degree to which you can quibble.
Just be grateful for what you can get, basically.
I mean, I don't know about that. I think Barra players, in my experience, are quite grateful for what they can get for the most part. Occasionally, they'll complain about cards that I think are really good, and it will annoy me. But for the most part, I think Barra players are among the more accepting whenever they get anything, because they've had so many cycles of not getting good stuff.
Well, I mean, what is a collectible or customizable card game without some kind of complaints about the cards your favorite faction is getting?
Yeah, well, the trick is to just be a heartless mercenary that plays whatever you want. You know, Tyrell one tournament, start
there. You go. Bounce from one to the other. I mean, there's definitely something to be said about that from a very Jamie perspective, but part of me misses some real identifiable faction loyalty. You know, even not all that long ago, you could still see some trends like a heavier Stark loyalty, so to speak, in Europe and abroad. But I feel like that's dissipated lately. So I don't know.
I think it still is true to an extent. I mean, we'll see for sure, I guess, when it comes to Starlek, how much numbers Stark and Greyjoy put up in Europe compared to what they put up in America. But it's an interesting one, loyalty. Like, I know this is absolutely nothing to do with Worlds Recap, but we have a little bit. But yeah, it's the interesting case of sort of like there's a romance to sticking with one faction and representing it and being an authority on it and, you know, people supporting the person who's playing on the stream because they're playing the faction that they care about and they believe in and they want to see that faction prosper. And then I'm kind of just looking at it from a purely, like, not even like a Jamie perspective so much as just like a cynical, like frugal perspective of I'm paying for a chapter pack of 20 different cards. And if I'm only using, you know, two of them plus the neutrals, I kind of feel like it's a waste in a way. I want to play silly decks with all of the different cards.
I can definitely see that. That makes sense. I mean, you could always try and divvy a collection with someone, but then you're just going to be squabbling over neutrals and it's a real mess.
Yeah. I have that bad enough with Keb because we steadfastly do not think it's worth buying a second complete connection when there's just two of us. But I know that our friends are getting pretty annoyed with us desperately trying to like borrow great hauls from everyone before.
Surely you could stock up on some champ decks or something to pick up some extra great hauls, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've literally never bought a champ deck either. I'm a terrible customer. I just buy the chapter packs and deluxe boxes.
If I'd won
World, I might have considered buying my own champ deck just out of pure vanity. But you don't get deck if you scrub out in the top four. So,
I mean, but a fantastic performance there, and you did wind up getting in on one of the days of Melee, right? And then still making the cut.
Yeah, no, yeah.
See, that's pretty spicy right there.
We had Thursday was day 1A of the Joust, which I got to play in, aka the Euro day, which, like, it's not just because there were Europeans in it. There was a lot of really good American players in it as well, but that was an obscenely difficult day. This is going to sound like a humble brag or something. I genuinely don't know how I kinked the Swiss in it because the list of amazing players who are much better than me, you know, you could count on more than two hands, I think, in that event. You've got, you know, the various national champions from Europe. I think only two Europeans were in day 1B of the Swiss. But then from America, you had, you know, Chris Thompson, Fred Bird, Chris Schoenthal, AJ Val, all these, you know, known players, let's put it that way.
Well, I think folks would be hard pressed to not include you in such a pool, especially considering your European championship. So I would say don't downplay yourself too much there.
It's been a good 12 months. I won't pretend it hasn't. But yeah, I was definitely my goal going into the whole tournament was make day 2. Like, I had no ambitions beyond just make day 2. So it turned out pretty well. But yeah, so that was Thursday. Then Friday was day 1A of the Melee, which clashed with day 1B of the Joust. So again, I'm going into this Melee thinking, oh, this is going to be really tough because all the Europeans are in it and Europeans take Melee really, really seriously. As it turns out, it was really tough, but that was not why. So I assume you've probably already covered this at least somewhat in the rest of the World's Recap episode. But ladies combo, that be a thing.
Turns out it is, though perhaps not one at Stalag. So there is definitely going to be somewhere that a change is made.
Yeah. Out of there was four rounds of Swiss. And then after that, the top 8 from day 1A would make it to the top 16. And then the following day, the top 8 from day 1B would make it to the top 16. So out of my four Swiss games, I had a game in which there was a ladies combo deck on my table. And I had three games in which there were two ladies combo decks on my table.
Oof.
And that was not fun. Like, I'm a big fan of Melee, and it upsets me when people disparage the format, but two ladies combo decks on the table is not recommended as a way to enjoy Melee, can confirm.
Oh, no. They don't wind up kind of having to pace and watch each other to make sure they're not enabling the other one?
No. No. So the first game, the first two players were the two ladies combo decks. And in turn one draw phase, they each found all three copies of Dragon's Tale and exchanged them with each other.
Ah.
With the basic theory being, if I Dragon's Tale with you, you'll Dragon's Tale with me. And neither me nor the other player at the table had a Dragon's Tale of our own to make the trade with. And so the player going first used the logic of, I will, you know, if I'm going first, I can just try and reach 15 before it even gets to
sure.
the second ladies combo player. Second ladies combo player using the logic of, well, if we can stop the first guy from winning, I win. And as it turns out, we could stop the first guy from winning, but not the second. And that ended in challenges phase round one before it even got to the third player. Thankfully, like that was a learning experience for me. Obviously, I finished fourth with 0 points. But for games two and four, which were the other two where there were two combo players, both times I deliberately didn't set up any characters. They set up two ladies with no dupes, and I got to do a turn one Valar Morghulis, which just filled me with joy. I miss from first edition getting to do turn one Valars all the time. And it turns out if you take off two of their ladies round one, especially when Eleanor Tyrell or Marcella Baratheon is one of those ladies, that the deck really struggles to get enough juice mm-hmm. to be able to just flood the board and win quickly. And having delayed both of those decks, I was able to go on to win both those games. And I also was able to win the game with only one ladies combo deck on. So I finished with 45 points from four rounds, which was not too bad. I think it was third best of day 1A. And then for day two of the melee, I tend to be quite positive with stuff. The way the top 16 was handled annoyed me a lot. So we have a top 16. One of the top 16 players from day 1B, after making the top 8 of day 1B, told the organisers that he was going to have to drop because he wasn't going to be around on the Sunday to play melee. And he told them that on the Friday of, on the Saturday, day 1B of melee. He told them this. And yet, when we got to the top 16, he was still included and obviously wasn't there, had to drop. And we had a three-player table.
Oh.
It's like, how hard would it have been to promote ninth place of the 1B Swiss up into the top 16?
Because that affects things so much more in Melee than even in Joust. Those three-player tables have a fundamentally, I think, very different dynamic. If you can maintain the perfect four breakdown, I think you really need to try.
Yeah, and it actually ended up not only not being a top 16, it wasn't even a top 15, because one of the other people that made the top 16 dropped because he wanted to get the prizes from playing in Kingsmoot. So he just collected his top 16 prizes and dropped, which, you know, it's fair enough, it's his right to do that. But again, how tough would it have been to promote another player into that slot? Like, slightly more tough than the other one, but still, like, it should have been a top 16, or at the very least, it should have been a top 15. Sorry. There was almost going to be a top 13 because Sandy was nowhere to be found after shots for plots from the night before. But thankfully, he was going to be on his way. So one of the top 16 games just started 15 minutes after the others.
I did see the post of that pairing sheet. So that was hilarious.
Yeah, the Sandy time. Yeah, that was good. Like, if more of it had been like that, it would have been enjoyable. But the problem I had with it was that not only did it mean that two of the top 16 tables were three-player games, the judges, like, we made the mistake of asking, are we allowed to use the rules that make three-player melee good? To which the judges, like, it's not their fault. They had to say no, because they didn't have the authority to overrule FFG's official rules, and FFG's official rules are nothing, basically. So we not only played a three-player melee in the top 16, we played a three-player melee with Crown Regent, with supports, and it was a farce, honestly. Like, it was my first game where there were ladies combo decks at the table, and it was my least favorite melee game. Just because it wasn't a game. Like, the, for me, what makes melee wonderful is the negotiation. And you can't negotiate when one person can only attack one of the other two players. So it was me, Justin Sainstock, and Eric Green. And Eric just couldn't do anything at any point in the game. And it's not his fault. He was playing a good deck. He was playing the Star Kraken. He wasn't doing anything wrong or anything. He just couldn't attack me. And Justin's deck was built around having big characters with renown that he kept standing, and Eric therefore couldn't attack Justin. And there was nothing he could do. And so that game just sort of trundled along. On the last round, I was able to take a few icons away from Justin's board and push through the win. And it felt kind of hollow, to be honest. But, you know, what can you do?
Oh, no. Competitively hollow. It strikes again.
It really, yeah. Yeah. I spoke to Danny afterwards, and he was quite upset. I think, like, he basically said he wants there to be official melee rules. So I don't know what exactly the holdup in the chain is. He also wants an updated melee restricted list. So it's, you know, I don't know where the delay in making melee officially good is coming from, but it's not from him. He wants what's best. Well,
for what it's worth, I might recommend to both of us and all the listeners that care about melee to probably go drop the organized play email address or comment form, whichever it was, a line to request those documents. I'm assuming that they're an important piece along that way at some point or another. So
would that be www.fantasyflightgames.com/en/op/feedback?
Wow, I believe it would. Man, you just knew that right off the top of your head. That's impressive.
I'm not saying that I've got that feedback form bookmarked, but...
But you're not saying...
It can make it easy to find sometimes. I'm going to just sort of heavily imply it. But yeah, the melee, thankfully, was capped off with a really good game. Probably my favorite game of the whole tournament. So that was me, Jesse Carpenter, Nick Hansen, and Alex Black. And that was, for me, what melee should be about, in that so much of it was talking and bargaining and blackmailing and, you know, occasionally playing, but mostly talking. And it came down to a final round in which realistically any of us could have won. Possibly Alex, least of all. He was playing ladies combo, and we'd made sure to victimize him as much as possible to try and reduce his chances of winning. But once it got to a point where he probably wasn't going to win, Nick, Jesse, and I all just turned on each other because we kind of had to. And it allowed Alex to get a sniff back into the game. Unfortunately for me, I misplayed my plot on the final round. I had a choice between Forgotten Plans and Summer Harvest. And I, you know, thought, well, it's going to be the final round. People are going to play their closer plots. At that point, you want to play Forgotten Plans. So I flipped that and met three when revealed effects. And as it turns out, if I'd flipped Summer Harvest, tide of one initiative and being able to go last. Instead, I had to go first, which isn't really what you want to do, because it was going to be the final round because of time, not because of people necessarily reaching 15 power. And it, what it meant is I just had to put as high a score on the board as possible and then just hope no one could surpass it. So I reached 11 power, I think it was. Alex goes second. We've hurt him enough. He doesn't see the cards he needs to see off his draws, and he stalls out at, you know, like 6 or 7 power. Then it gets to Jesse, and Jesse is playing his Martell Reigns deck with Doran's Game and Scorpion Sting and so on. And from Alex's attempts to win, Jesse has been able to trigger a Scorpion Sting, so he's got like 5 characters with Renown. So the only way that Jesse can win, realistically, is if he wins a challenge with all these characters and he gets off a Doran's Game and uses the Doran's Game to reach 15. So after a lot of thinking, a lot of talking, Jesse eventually aims it at Nick. And Nick does the calculations, looks at his power total, looks at my power total, and again, after a lot of thinking, realizes the only way, like the only route he has to victory is if he lets Jesse's challenge go through, gives Jesse the opportunity to either play the Doran's Game and win, play the Doran's Game and have it cancelled by either me or Alex having a hand's judgment, or reveal that he didn't have a Doran's Game after all and was just sort of bluffing it. Because if Nick figured he could stop the Doran's Game, but if he did, he would hand the game to me. So he had to play to the route that gave him a chance at winning. And Jesse did have Doran's Game, and neither Alex nor myself had a cancel. So Jesse just won. And if I'd been going last, then potentially Nick would have been able to stop Jesse, and then, you know, it would have come down to me or Nick for the win. But that's the game.
Yep. I mean, that is, I think, the hallmark of a good Melee game to me. It's a different mindset, as we've said many times. I definitely know there are some folks that would listen to that type of story and lament that some decisions were out of their hands in that case, and some of that outcome was.
It's my fault for losing initiative, isn't it?
I think maybe so. And it does sound like, you know, decisions were made across the board in each individual player's best interest. And I can't fault that at all.
Yeah, no, both Alex and Nick did things that helped Jesse to win, but neither of them did it to help Jesse to win. They did it to help themselves to have a chance of winning, and it just backfired and led to Jesse's victory.
Yeah. What's the quote to steal from another fantasy series? Even the very wise cannot see all ends. Something along those lines. But alas, speaking of ends, I hate to say it, but I think we may need to draw this interview to a close. We've gone well past our allotted time, but I think it was a good one.
You know, 40 minutes, 20 minutes, it's basically the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was close enough. It's all under an hour.
Yeah. Well, sorry for rambling on so much.
Oh, no, no. Like, that's
talk more about both Joust and Melee, but,
well, you know,
it's fun to chat sometimes rather than to say what you were meant to actually say.
Exactly. Well, and part of that is definitely my fault in directing things into some Stalic speculation and questions about Kohor and that sort of thing. So, you know, I led the interview in places it was not originally intended to go.
I'd very quickly then like to just say thank you to everyone at Worlds, because it was a really, really awesome time. And the main reason for that was getting to hang out with a bunch of people. Some of them for the second time after having gone to Gen Con a couple of years ago, some of them meeting for the first time. It was a really, really good time. Everyone just made us feel welcome, made us happy to be there. You know, everyone was fun to go out drinking with. Like, it was just a really good time. Obviously, for Europeans, it's quite expensive to fly out to Minnesota, but if anyone gets the chance to go, I recommend it.
Awesome.
Although I do have to slop you, Will, of course, because this is the second time I've gone to a major tournament in America, And it's the second time that you've dodged me.
I know. I am very bummed. I was actually about to express my dismay at not making it. So we're trying to shuffle and reorganize and kind of figure out some of our planning for the future. So hopefully, maybe that does not happen again. Assuming you do make it stateside again.
I was going to say, we'll have to either have me win Euros or Nationals, or have you win a Road to Starlek event.
Okay. Deal.
Or both, and then we can both end up missing each other again.
Somehow we both wind up in the other one's country while the other one's here or there.
Yeah. It will be like one of those wacky, like, wife swap things. Only instead of wives, it's grown.
Yeah. They could record it, make a whole movie out of it. It'd be great.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much for joining me and matching up on the interview here, despite some scheduling difficulties and some poor memory on my own part. So we matched up on that, at least.
Cool. Thanks very much for having me.
We'll see. But this is definitely the Y Book once again. Unfortunately, I was not at Worlds. So I brought a bunch of guests on this week that were at Worlds. And, I think all of them have some pretty relevant background and history and titles and things to their name. Some from this weekend, some from a couple months back, some from many, many moons ago. So this week I've got Kyle, who, minor spoiler alert, we'll talk about this more, but he is now our reigning Shots for Plots champion, if I understood correctly, right?
I do drink a lot.
Awesome.
It's not a problem.
We'll keep working our way backwards. We've got Tyler on, who is our reigning North American / Gen Con champ. And I know I misquoted this earlier, so why don't you tell me how far into the cut you made it at Worlds?
Ended up top 32 at Worlds. Or my metamates went top 16, top 8. We were piloting pretty much the same deck. But it was a pretty good showing for us overall, I thought.
Yeah, I think that's freaking awesome. Well, we'll come back around to your deck a little bit here too. Our last guest, we're gonna focus on him for a little bit since he's gonna have to run soon. We've got friend of the show, and I think maybe guest host once before. And oh yeah, 2000, what was it, 6 world champ, 5 world champ, something like that. Matt Lowe.
Oh, I think you go back that far, doesn't matter. But yeah,
that's fair. But I mean, you had a really good run at Worlds this year too, though, right? What was your final?
Yeah, the top 16. So I like to say ninth, since I was the highest seed to lose that.
Yeah, I mean that's
sad and okay at the same time. So let's say ninth. It sounds better than
I mean, I'm willing to give you a ninth, especially because I mean you're king of Swiss, i.e. undefeated in your day of Swiss, right?
Yeah, on my day. So co-kings of Swiss with
Wamsley.
I'm Wamsley.
Called Wama.
Yes, Wamsley. Yeah. There you go. Wama, there you go. That's what the word I was looking for and I couldn't get to. So yeah, we both went 6-0 on. He went on day one, and I was day two.
Nice.
Day two is the much harder field.
That's yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah,
let's go with that.
We won't comment on the standings that I saw that listed you below him in the list in the number two spot, but whatever.
I think that was strength of schedule, and I think you railed about that already. will, so I'll go and
yeah, there we go. Now. Okay, that's fair. Well, so how did the rest of, or maybe not the rest, but how did that portion of the weekend go? I think you and Kyle were virtually running the same deck, right? How did that come about?
Oh, me and Kyle and Tommy out of Chicago just started talking about decks, and at that point I was on a Tar Greyjoy thing that I was actually enjoying, you know, for lots of saves and a little more stealth and things of that sort. But actually, I think I emailed you as well, Will, and I basically said, here's the things I want to do in my deck. I want control, repetitive control. I want to be able to survive Valor. I want to be fairly quick, and I want control of both locations and people in it. And I want card draw, of course. It's always good, right? So I said those things, and after we went back and forth, somebody mentioned the Bay of Crabs deck. Is that correct,
Kyle? I know someone. Said I am that? The someone, yes.
Oh, yes, yes. I was saying, is that right? That's why I was confirming. So we said that, and we looked at that, and we kind of liked how it looked, and didn't know it was going to be as popular as it was at all at Worlds, but we all just liked the play style, and I know Kyle was looking at a lot of stuff, and so long story short, he went forward with
not
it.
Not what I
and,
expected. We at the all story short, knowing rings, I expected some very different words right there.
I don't know how rated R this is.
Let's keep it PG-13. I couldn't.
We have a mature rating. We have a mature rating.
No, I don't think we've re-earned it, have we? I think when we rebooted it as the White Book, we've stayed normal.
That's fucking stupid.
Oh, thanks, yeah. Kyle. It's because I have to do things like write down that
and
time
there it goes.
And go back and edit out Kyle's language.
Yeah, anyway, we brought little slightly different ones than those guys. Obviously my changes were a lot better than Kyle's.
But, so true.
I changed a few things up, and I did actually enjoy them. They were total dumb luck, but the things I did change, Dromans and putting in whatever is Belwas and just a few other little things. Actually, they came to be there. I think we all put in Seized at one point. We were scared of locations and mirror matches a little bit. So we did a lot, but we ran the Red Door Targ deck, which ended up being fairly popular. And last year's world champion played a superior version, I thought, against me in the top 32, but I just got out faster.
I'm curious about some of those changes, or at least one in particular. The JC Dromans, how did those actually wind up panning out for you over the weekend?
They worked out pretty well. Targ, the good thing is you're always pitching cards, so if it's not for that real deck, it's not the worst thing in the world. So I took out the zero cost plus one golds, whatever the roads. And put those in just for a little more utility, and they helped against Stark. At one point, I was playing a straight up Targ, and he was putting out two Marines. He put out two Marines to try to mash me on Marines, and I hammered both of those out. Got Skagos. What else did I get? And it comboed really well with the. Is it the? I'm really bad with card names. Sorry, guys. The
cold, nothing
the
burns.
Fire
like
that
the
burns
cold.
Or whatever.
Yeah, nothing.
The plot that gets rid of an attachment. There we go. Nothing. I knew there was cold and hot in there. It was like a, I don't know, like icy hot or something. But it comboed well with that, where I could get the small one and then maybe get the big one later. So I thought it did well for me. I have to admit, I pitched it a lot too, but in certain matchups, it was gold.
Nice. So most of your matchups then obviously went pretty well. Any amusing anecdotes from the weekend, particularly sweet plays you enjoyed or anything?
Gosh, you know, it's so hard after that weekend. Everything kind of goes together. And to be honest, I really didn't think I was going to play all that well. I play four times a year. As you guys know, I play at Kubla. I play at Kubla, and I play at WillyCon, which is not really playing cards as much as it's the drinking side. Kyle and Will have both been there, and this year I think we played more tag and different games of that sort than we actually played Game of Thrones. We played golf, we played a lot of things. But so those two, and then Worlds, and then I played obviously Isle Worlds or Low Worlds, whatever, and that's about it. So I have no one in town anymore that plays. So I didn't think I'd do very well, long story short. And so,
man, so you didn't get any actual test games of your own in with the deck before Worlds?
Two on Thursday with Tommy.
Wow.
So I don't play Iron Throne either. So luckily, see, Kyle,
that one actually surprises me. Iron Throne's pretty slick. I remember showing it to you at WillyCon, actually.
Yep. It's, I should probably do it. I wish I had a better excuse, but I don't. So I just rode Kyle and Tommy's thoughts, but it was pretty good. Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys tested it. It didn't make a lot of
Deck is actually illegal now. The Bay Crabs list. It runs Breaking Ties and Flea Bottom. So just naturally, we had to do some tweaking. But I don't think we changed a whole lot from it. Right. I really dug the list. I kind of made a resolve before this world. Like, if I'm going to drive all the way up there, like, and do this, like, let's time to not suck. Like, let's not put in a 6-hour car ride to go 1-5. Thoughts. So I really started grinding out some games, and I really liked it. And before that, I was on a really strong Night's Watch Stark kick. But I think, like a lot of people, we were expecting a ton of Greyjoy to be out.
It stepped up in day two from what I saw in the numbers, but overall in the tournament, not as much maybe as I.
Yeah, it's like everyone swang to the. Like anti-medical, like the whole meta did the opposite. And I like Ring said, I think we were very surprised at how popular our deck was. Like I talked to some people about it and they'd be like, yeah, it's a really good deck. It's a really good deck, but I'm not playing it. I'm like, all right, cool. So I think we were all shocked. But yeah, I was probably grinding out 7-8 games a day with it the last 2 weeks, trying to get in the reps, figure out the minutiae, get comfortable. Every night talking with Tommy and Rings about, okay, here's what I'm seeing, here's what's good against, what's bad against. It was just real, real organic process, just a quick 3-man team trying to hammer something out. But it was good.
Awesome.
Yep. I can't say anything different than that. They convinced me on a few plots, even though I had maybe one different than Kyle, but I wasn't sold on the King plot. And it was awesome. The no king, the world champ 5-2-1. I'm so bad with names. Somebody can correct me if they want. If not, that's fine. But the one where you need a king was
king in the north
all day, and they convinced me of that. That thing's awesome. And so it worked really well. It slows a lot of things down, and those guys convinced me that was great against Greyjoy. And so it was really good. Find a game I remember the most. It was top 32. Was last year's World Reinhardt.
Reinhardt
from Austria, and since he's not Reinhardt, there you go. He's not on Facebook, so I don't see his name as much as others. And he's just such a gentleman and so awesome. And I jumped all over him at the beginning. He was running a, like I said, a little better match, but I got Drogon out early, but then he just kept needling back. And Marine lets you do that. That's why I love Marine. Is that you're never out. You know, you're looking at. Looking at three cards, putting them down.
So good.
He was running a lot more events in Shadowback Lane, which I had kind of thought of. Shadowback Lane was one of my last cuts. And he was running that. And so he was really using Danny to a lot of extent. So I got him to Valor turn two, came back and had three fatties right after that, though. And luckily, I got to 15 power on the last turn in dominance right before he was going to, I think he was going to flip it. Maybe I would have won the next turn if I would have got a challenge off, but I was running out of answers and he had lots of answers. So. The last turn, I seized his Astapor, which a couple of people around me groaned because they thought I should do Marine, I guess. But that certainly won it for me. Was probably my favorite game. But, you know, played Ryan Jones, beat him, which I never beat Ryan Jones anymore. 3 years ago, I got beat twice the whole weekend. The year that Alvaro won, maybe it's 4 years ago. I lost two games all weekend, both to Ryan Jones. He just seems to own me the last few years. So got to beat him, got to beat, you know, a Wausau guy, got to beat some good, really good players. So it was a fun weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounded like you definitely played some stars on your way out.
You got to at World, you know, you got to. So, but, you know, I come down and slap that Ghost of High Art on the table and just intimidate him. You know, and
yeah, definitely.
They're back.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, I was talking to the German guy who won, and he's a very nice guy as well. And I was there with Nickler. You guys remember Nickler?
I haven't seen him in forever. He was at Worlds?
Yeah. He just came out to drink.
Ah, man.
And so Nickler came out to drink. And anyway, we were talking to the German champion. He goes, how do you guys know each other? Oh, well, Nickler used to work for FFG and played. And I said, we played together, what, 2005, 2006? And the German guy goes, I was 10.
So, oh, Lord.
That was something.
Wow. Jeez, I feel old now.
Yeah, my son is 11, so yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, okay, on that depressing note, I know you don't have much longer before you actually need to go take care of some kiddos. I am pretty curious, though, since you don't get to play at least Thrones in particular all that much anymore. And yet, obviously, like, still have it together from a performance standpoint. I mean, you did well here. You made the cut at what, Gen Con last year, and like, you know, you're still performing really well. Like, are there particular strategies or, you know, thought processes that you go through, or ways you kind of prioritize your play that you think, like, helps keep you up there, or do you think it's all just sheer dumb luck?
Oh, it's certainly part of both. I mean, Kyle is just as good of a player as I is, and he didn't make the cut. Tommy is up there, you know, they're both good players. So a lot of it's dumb luck and matchups. But, you know, I've been playing since the day the game came out, and I do believe that helps a little, is that there's reps in the past. So that helps a little. Some of it is just play the deck you know that is your play style. Some people love to play one where they play two events and get 15 power that, you know, that Martell won, and that's their play style. I could not play that in a million years. I know I want control. I want to clear the board, reduce the decision points down to something that's a little more manageable. That makes me sound like a moron, but that's kind of, I like to have a clean board where I'm controlling it in my own way and not overthinking it. Just almost every card, I like to control the board somehow or stop myself from being controlled, like Belwas or some others. So I play pretty dumb decks, I believe. Some people might disagree, but I think I play straightforward, hit you in the mouth sort of decks and then try to meta with the plots against some things. I thought really hard, even running a heavy location deck, about running the anti-location plot. Yeah. It might have done well for me. Political Disaster, I believe, is the name. And so, you know, just try to control things and go from there. So I guess that's my biggest advice, not that I should give it, but is to find a deck and a play style that you really like and boil it down to something like that.
I mean, it sounds like Targ then checks virtually all boxes. Though I know historically you've been like very kind of anti-location, like in your own play even. Did it pain you to play as many locations as you probably had to in that deck?
I've gotten over that a little by necessity. I think the most boring thing in the world is to draw a location and play a location. Now, some locations interact in a way that's fun, so I'm overstating that. But I've always been a kind of Nedley player in my own way, and you guys know I hate non-uniques. I hate playing random Chud 96. I like playing Tywin or Drogon or whoever it is. I like uniques a lot. And so they usually have really cool abilities, and it just makes more for variance game to game if you don't have just a bunch of Chuds in there. So You know, it's its own thing on that side. And I was used to be a huge
Wanny player. Was good.
That's when in the old days you had, you had push button control in every house. You really did. You had playable swords, free swords and tiers at one point. Even there was a power one that set confiscation, I think, or something else that brought them back, people back to hand. Every challenge was its own, like, oh no, if I lose this challenge, they might control my board. And now they've limited the amount of houses that really truly can control the board as very much. So, yeah, so that made Targ, you're right. Targ now with the kind of draw they have, makes them kind of an easy play for me. But, in the past, I didn't play much Targ. It's true.
Right on. Well, I think we're pretty close to your time limit here, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and sorry about that. As I've said many times, I'm old. My grasp of technology is slight, so I apologize to you guys for having to listen through my
no worries,
my
no worries.
Old man
now that you've problems. Got the software installed and you know which software we're going to have to use to get you on, we'll drag you back on the show again. I don't know, maybe after IO Worlds or something, and we'll make you actually talk for a whole episode.
That sounds great. I appreciate it, guys, and thanks for having me on.
Hey Kyle, I was wanting to know, I didn't get a chance at Matt before he got off, was he running Pinch of Powder in his deck?
Yeah, Matt ended up sticking one in there at the end. It was something that me and Tommy had thought about, and we're just nervous on the win by five, especially on Intrigue Power, with the deck's mildly military focused if you think about Drogo and Drogon and some of the other characters, but Pinch is the cliche card that Matt loves, and you kind of heard him talk about it there. Pinch makes, you know, 2/3 of your challenges dangerous by itself. So, you know, Matt's philosophy, and he kind of touched on it, you know, if every challenge is dangerous or can be dangerous, you don't know as his opponent which one really is. So the moment you see Pinch, now you're worried about those two. And let's say he plays a die by the sword. So now you just don't know what to defend. And eventually you are going to make a mistake on one of those feints, or he's going to bait you into a trap where you overcommit to defense and then he swings on the other one. And those are the moments he loves. And again, it's a card that pairs down the board, because pairing down the board is a big theme in all the times like me and Matt talk about decks. It's what he wants. And it makes sense, because if the board is small, A, as his opponent, it limits your choices to make plays that are going to get you ahead. And for him as the player, it simplifies the game, and he can focus on more of the interactions. There's less things to worry about, and you can focus on strategy and move on to some next level things. Like, okay, well, these are the only three characters that are out, so here's how I can very easily bait so-and-so into that pinch play. If there's eight characters out, there's a million more scenarios you have to run through, and it makes setting those traps more difficult. And those are the kind of things that Matt loves to do. Like, so walk you into a mistake, and then pounce on it. He talks a lot about, you know, I don't get to play much, and I'm not really familiar with the game, and that's true. When you listen to him talk, he struggles with, the cards, but when you play him, and you're watching him go through his motions mentally, he's just looking for playing concepts that he knows are mistakes, overcommitting, letting things go unopposed that you shouldn't. It's almost like a boxing match. He pokes and prods, and it's like, all right, well, he keeps letting these chump challenges go through, so I'm going to rack up a ton of power. If he's not going to care about intrigue challenge, I'm just going to keep stealing those. Or he likes to, he's really been protecting his hand, so I'm going to fake this pinch move, make him all out defend, and then flea bottom in second sons, do the power challenge, and then pop his big two. Like, he likes setting up the play and looking for you to make conceptual mistakes. So he doesn't have to know your cards to be able to do that. And I think that's kind of why these like world champs can stick around and like keep being good despite the reps. Like Ryan Jones and him don't play a lot, but they show up and just like still make top 16s. And the reason they do that is because they understand playing concepts better than most of us, that they don't need the cards to still be good enough to make that level.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth pointing out, like, Matt doesn't get to play a lot of Thrones anymore, but it's not like he's not playing card games of some kind all the freaking time. It's just, you know, a lot more casual stuff or testing things out with his kids or whatever, but like he's always tinkering with mechanics and like some of that baseline poking and prodding, and like the way you do that may be a little different in different games, but I think the process of actually figuring that out is probably pretty similar, even if the game mechanics are different. I don't know. It also kind of terrifies me thinking about what he would actually be like if he was able to like grind out games on like a weekly basis or something. Yeah. You know?
It'd be over. I mean, he'd be a celebrity in the game, like more so than he is now. Like, I think the old guard is aware of Matt Lay, and anytime he shows up, he can beat you. But I think, you know, if he had the support behind it, I mean, and look at this, right? Like, me and Tommy coached him into the deck and what we're trying to do, what we're trying to accomplish, and here's the reps, and here's what we're seeing. And between games, we're kind of, you know, giving him little tidbits, like, okay, so we're seeing a lot of Stark, and here's how those reps have typically gone. You're trying to, like, get him going. Like, when he played Shannon in top 16, he came to us, he's like, I literally, other than it's Martell and it runs that stupid intrigue event, I know nothing about what that deck does. I don't know what's in it. I don't know how it works. I don't know what it's doing.
That is a deck you probably want to know.
Yeah, and I'm like, this deck won Gen Con. Like, so
we literally have the pilot in it with us right now.
With us, yes. And he's so like, Matt's like, I have no idea, and he still goes in there and does relatively well. Like, ends up losing that game, but I mean, that's what it was every round. He's like, I don't know. He's like learning the deck as he's playing against it, and then wins. I mean, just goes undefeated playing top level talent than people that have prepped for weeks and months for this. Like, it is an incredible skill set.
It really is. It's,
but there's a lot to learn as a player from that.
There's definitely something to be said for a natural talent, you know?
and I mean, I think Kyle's right, that the level of talent there that he's walking into pretty much cold was incredible. I mean, every single person you were up against seemed to be a national champion, world champion, European champion of some sort. It was, you know, there were no easy games all day, and to do that on the fly like that that's something I envy for sure.
It's pretty impressive. On the other, oh, go ahead, Kyle. I was gonna transition, but this might be a good one for me. Jump on it.
My one last point I'll say is, and I've noticed this a lot lately in conversations I have with people, is that I don't think we talk about those soft skills and things to look for as a player as much. I hear a lot of people talk about card on card interactions. They play this, so we play this to counter it. And it's much more so like, here's how you move the chess pieces, and less of the why and the improvisation and the creativity. Like, I don't think we as players focus on that as much anymore. Yeah. In our games. And I think that's a vital piece that if you're someone who's looking to take the next step in your Thrones career, like, understand, like, talk to people who are better than you and be like, why do we play the cards? Ask the why. The why is how you get to the next level. Like, okay, so I get it. Like, you like Skagos. Why do you like Skagos? What makes this play good? What makes this interaction good? Why do you set things up the way you do? Why did you break away from the normal intrigue mill pow and go to like military pow intrigue? Like, why jazz it up? Like, what, like understand, the more you understand the why, the better you are going to become as a player.
You know, this may be a big topic to go down and really examine, but part of me wonders if that more, let's say, programmatic approach that I do agree has become more prevalent in the game, like it feels like that might be related to the rise in build groups. You know, kind of similar to what you were saying with like you and Tommy kind of be in more in the know and kind of tweaking the deck and kind of pointing Matt in the right direction. Like when I can't help but wonder if build groups all working on these same decks tend to do that because you need these, you know, 3 to 6 or, you know, 20 people, however many it is in a particular group, all, you know, on board in front from a strategy sense. Like you need a set of programming instructions. This is what you do with X card in Y situation. I hadn't thought about it the same way until you brought it up, but it's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, back to the segue. We're gonna jump back to how we were talking about rings. You know, learning things on the fly and not knowing that Martell deck and that sort of thing. And even sort of segueing here on the topic of build groups, because Quincy was all on the same deck, right, Tyler?
Yeah, we ended up going with a Martell deck that was substantially similar to what we were piloting at Gen Con.
Ooh.
In fact, so
how'd that shake out? What sent you that way? Did you make many updates, or was it pretty much the same?
We, in playing and getting ready for heading up here, this was our first Worlds event as a Quincy meta. And we got some playtesting in, not nearly as much as we did prior to Gen Con, which was unfortunate, but in what I was seeing, both playing online and then trying different decks out, seeing what we could pull from friends and stuff from other areas, what they were playing and copying decks and getting reps in with other stuff. We really anticipated that there was going to be, kind of like Kyle had said earlier, a lot of Greyjoy with their new tricks and stuff that they had recently and the success that they had as well in recent tournaments. And then still having that fear of the speed decks, the Start Crossing, to a lesser extent, Lanny Crossing and maybe Tar Crossing even. So we wanted something that we knew was resilient, something that was going to be able to not only play that quick game and control the board early, but also still have the oomph to come back if we do get behind against the mid-tier decks, the regular Stark Fealties, that try to control that early game and then push through in the middle and still have some punch from us to come in and wrap that up late if we have to. So we ended up playing with kind of what we were comfortable with, and we thought it didn't get hurt too bad with those new restrictions that came out on the Joust restricted list. You know, obviously with Wars being added, it limited what options we kind of had to pivot from what we were playing at Gen Con. And I think the biggest thing that I regret not having access to was that Littlefinger's meddling. I think seeing how that impacted us in the tournament in Gen Con versus not having it here at Worlds, I think that would have been something we would have liked to see. But obviously with Wards and that being on the same list, we had to make some changes. And that was one of the big things. We shifted some of our plots around a little bit. I think all three of us ended up putting in Uneasy Truce in that spot, again, to try to slow the game down a little bit and build on Martell's strengths there in the end game, which I think we had a lot of success with all day and in just about every matchup, just to be able to kind of say, well, we're going to take a turn off and get us either a chance to rebuild a little bit or just get that extra plot in to push through with that late inning Doran's game. So that was one of the bigger things we added to that. On top of that, we ended up going a little bit more icon stripping this time around, adding in a couple different things. I think the biggest addition that I thought paid dividends all day was the addition of Starfall. That was not in my original list leading in the Gen Con tournament, but with the presence of the hyper aggression decks, you know, the Free Folk and the Targ decks with Drogon and even with the Crossing decks, just to be able to take that one icon away could be the difference between them closing out early and not being able to. So we thought that was a really good addition as well. We ended up all three putting in some amount of, he calls it thinking. That's the new Martell event that is a cancel for any triggered condition unless they pay one gold. It was really hit or miss. I still don't know how I feel about it overall. I ended up playing two of it. The other people in my meta ended up playing three copies, I think, of that. And it was so up and down for me. Some games it seemed like it paid dividends, and others it was just a useless card I kept drawing at the end of the game. So it's definitely one of those that I'm on the fence about still. I think it's in and of itself it's a very good card, but I think with all the surplus of economy, all the decks that are saving the gold for other things, it's less impactful later on as it is early. So that's kind of my thought.
I have been wondering how effective that would be, because there's a lot of times, you know, I went back and forth on when I saw that card come out, you know, is this going to be a killer or is this something you shrug off? Because like I said, late game, a lot of times, like maybe you always have that gold and it's not, you know, you shrug and does nothing. But did any of like your meta mates have any like really great plays with it or anything you saw on that side?
I think they did. I think the biggest impact it had was in the Targ matchup, which, as you guys are well aware, was a significant portion of that field, especially on day two that we were all playing in there. But just to trigger and cancel that, you know, that early Aegon or you know, get rid of that Dracarys or that Drogon trigger, on those first couple turns where they're pretty well maxed out on their gold, that's where it really paid dividends. I know Robert in our play group ended up using it to stop an Aegon and then follow it up on the next turn with canceling either a Dracarys or a Dragon Is No Slave or some other burn effect, which he said really helped him in that matchup. And I know in his top 16 game, he ended up canceling Queensguard triggers quite a bit with it, which he thought was pretty good. I didn't have nearly as much success with it, I thought, throughout the day, and it could have just been what my matchups were versus his. But it's one of those I'm still kind of on the fence about. I think that obviously the impact of the card is great if it's working. It's just I couldn't get it to work very well.
So I'm curious then, you guys were both there and obviously, you know, put a lot of thought into, you know, what the field was going to be like and how what you're taking was going to fit into that. You know, were there any big surprises in things you saw this weekend at Joust? Standout decks or big trends aside from just Greyjoy not turning up in the force that most people were expecting, or was it all pretty run of the mill at large?
I thought for the most part, It was kind of what we were anticipating. A lot of Targ, a lot of Stark. I kind of thought there might be some more Free Folk decks running around. I don't know how many there were on day one.
Yeah, did we ever get any sort of stats on that? I was afraid there would be a good chunk, but I could never get a feel.
I didn't hear or see any.
I know there was one that made the cut just because he was paired across from me when we were checking in. We were just chit-chatting about that. But as far as the exact number, I have no idea. I just thought with the how powerful that agenda is, I thought more people might be on that train to try to combat the speed of the meta right now. But I think having watched some of the games, seen some of the deck lists that have been posted, I thought that Walmsley's deck, the Stark deck he piloted, the Stark Fealty with the Skagos and the Big Cad, and his version I liked a lot. I thought it was very creative overall. Obviously, he's one of the best players in the world. But just to see the ideas and the themes and the things he was playing on really, really thought was very impressive. I know there were some other decks. I think the Long Lances group were running a similar deck, which also had some very interesting mechanics and synergies in it. So both of those I didn't have much exposure to. We as a meta didn't have much of exposure to going in. It's something we had to kind of pick up on the fly, and I think we ended up dealing with overall pretty well. But that was something I thought was interesting, bringing another passive power deck. Similar to the passive power deck they ran before with Tyrell, where they're just kind of focusing on themselves and trying to win before you can get set up and get your stuff working. I thought that was kind of what they were. I wasn't expecting a lot of that with the restricted list and the game as a whole kind of shifting away from that. But
the big thing that the big thing that surprised me with Skagos being out there, and I thought was going to be fairly popular, especially, I didn't think, I would be shocked if you saw a Stark deck that either red doored for it or is running two, if not three, in their deck. So I just thought it would be insanely popular. And that Stark would be a top four house, top four, top three house. And I thought Skagos would turn off a lot of attachments, negative attachments. Just with Skagos being able to blink them away. I thought this will be like the attachment game was just not going to be a thing. And then with having Skagos, you would definitely not see confiscation because Skagos would then be the cure for that. But I think three, if not four, of my opponents ran confiscation and I saw a ton of negative attachments all day. I saw tons
all of the wards.
Yeah, I saw wards and frozen solids. I know we ran seized. I did not see seized out of anybody else. And again, small sample size. You only see six games out of however many. Saw cravens. I was surprised. And again, the confiscations, I did not expect the attachment game to be as pivotal as it ended up being. That was a huge surprise for me. The attachments mattered more, it felt like, at this Worlds than a lot of the big tournaments I've been at in the last year or two.
I would agree with that. I think he's right. I think just about every person I played was running some sort of confiscation or other way to deal with negative attachments, which, again, I thought we had kind of shifted away from, since Gen Con and leading up to Worlds. I wasn't anticipating that much at all. And kind of along those same lines, I thought there might be a more of an outpouring of Kohar decks and building on that synergy that I think is very strong agenda in the meta right now, especially with what I was anticipating seeing versus what there actually were. I did see a couple Kohar decks and Kohar Alliance decks that did well. Kind of the Queen's Guard or Danny Steed decks that were run by some of the European players, but other than that, I didn't see a whole lot of Kohar either, which I thought might have an uptick with the success it had in Europe. So.
Yeah, I was really scared for that. I did play one Voltron John deck that was Night's Watch, Alliance, Tyrell, Kohor. But I expected that to be really big just because it's so flexible. And it's a cool thing to bring to a tournament like this because you can, if you build it right, react to the wide variety of things you're going to see at Worlds. And especially innovative decks. I think every conversation I had with someone, they saw at least one deck that they thought was super cool that they talked about because people right. save the hot sauce for Worlds. So you see some real innovation and some wild like counter meta plays that you haven't heard anyone talk about that someone's just been homebrewing and refining and believes in and has the reps. And so Kohor seems like something that would thrive in this environment. And it was surprising not to see it. On the flip side, I can also see that's got to be a real grindy deck to try and figure out, okay, when do I go at what and da 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 and work through all of those decision right. points for 6 to 10 rounds has to be a bit of a grind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, Kyle, I was wondering, did you get a chance to look at that Targ deck that ended up playing Dragons. In the finals and also House Red Door Marine deck?
Brad's deck? I did not. I had some discussion at the bar that night about it. Like Ring said earlier, we were real jealous of it and real jealous of Reinhard's list. I think we're the two HRD Marine decks that we really liked what they were doing compared to what we did. And that just shows, you know, we put some effort in, but I am not a strong deck builder. That's not where my strength lies. And it just goes to show you when someone takes something and can augment it to a level, you're like, yep, that's better. Yep, that's better. I was real impressed with the way they took it, and I think that's a way better play. I definitely think it handled the like Stark heavy meta better than ours did. It was more prepared to take what we actually ended up seeing at Worlds than our list. I think we were kind of vulnerable to it, and it certainly was not.
Yeah, I thought they made some interesting choices. Watching that finals game on Twitch, I went back and rewatched it again. And first of all, I think he's a really incredible player for not playing Thrones all that much, coming in and doing as well as he did. But he made some really interesting choices, not running a reset, you know, minimizing the burn, maximizing the aggression. Really thought he did a good job. Be interesting to see if he posts that deck list to get a full breakdown of what exactly he had in there. But it was definitely a step above the decks that I build as well. So hopefully he'll share that information with us and take a look at it.
So. I would hope so. And usually people that get that high up show it. I really liked the... so again, like this is like the first Ed and me coming out, but because I realize it's not this way anymore, but like with Targ and especially with HRD Marine, you expect the burn. You're going to play around the burn. So even though he doesn't have it on some of it, he gets some of that intimidation and threat of activation, perks without having to use them. Now, obviously once you make the cut and everyone sees your list, that goes away, but I think it's a really clever move getting through Swiss, you know, and then again, maximizing aggression and being like caring more about the board state. And again, I think that matches up with Stark really well. It's like, I'm going to go toe to toe with you on sure. this and not have to use events or go around you. It's like, I'm going to hit you in the mouth, square on and be able to come out. Okay. Like, I think it's impressive.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think both of them are in such a good position right now. And there's so much synergy their cards have. I'm not going to be surprised if we continue to see a lot of Stark and Targ going forward here leading up to to Iowa Worlds and then into next tournament season there.
Yeah, I will
We're not going to have many other cards between now and then, right?
Truth. Yeah, that's Greyjoy box, right. And then that's it.
Yep.
So, yeah, and I really like the finals. Someone was telling me that, I think it was on the white book, where Danny said he envisions the game only going 3 to 4 plots. Like, that's his goal for the game. He likes the average game to go that. So to see the finals kind of slog on like that, like, those are the kind of matches I love. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh, but Danny's just, like, moaning that this is dragging how it is. But I'm like, this is good. Like, and like you said, both decks synergized and functioned and flowed so well. It was such a good game to watch play out the way it did. Like, that was a match deserving of, like, a world title. That was good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the back and forth, I mean, even the commentators were, oh, he's ahead now, and then the next plot they'll flip something up, and then it completely shifted the other way, and the other person was ahead, and the back and forth of it was just intense. It was great to watch, and I'm sure it was a nervous wreck to play in, but they both did a fantastic job.
Like, I've never obviously made it to the finals, but I'm sure you can attest to this. Like, I remember when Gen Con was all, like, one day, and just, like, the mental drain and, like, what you are in those top 8 matches. And I mean, that's as far as I've gone, but like it's the hamster is dead. Like, the wheel is just running on pure inertia at that point. And so to see them play as well as they did that far into their second day of doing it, you know, like, the grind, it's hard to appreciate that when you're not there and in the moment.
Yeah. Oh, those long days are just killer. I don't know if we needed to have this split over 3 days the way it was this year, but oh well. Thrones was back on good days, at least, not in the middle of the week.
Yes, appreciate the good days. And 130 is not a terrible turnout. I know it's not as big as years past, but, you know, like, it is a healthy group. It was good to see. It's easy to be optimistic about the future of the community when you get that kind of turnout. And a large international presence. You know, like, it sucks saying this as an American, but, you know, kudos to Europe for the turnout they had and the number of people they had come over for this. You know, it really makes it feel like a world's event. Like Tyler said, you know, like, everyone, it seems like everyone you sit down across, oh, I was national champ in Poland, I was national champ in Spain, I'm the Stalag champ from 2015. Like, everyone has won something, and it felt like worlds.
That's awesome. I'm really glad to hear that. Maybe eventually worlds can kind of lose some of the stigma it's had about not really being worlds, you know?
I think it's definitely a step in the right direction, for sure.
Well, okay. Also, on the weekend, I would be pretty remiss on the white book if I did not bring up the other tournament of note, or at least the important one to me from the weekend, which is Melee. Did both of you guys wind up playing in the Melee?
I did not. I ended up making a couple rounds in Joust, and then by the time I got knocked out, they were already well underway.
I grinded out my 4 rounds of Melee. They happen.
You're sighing here.
What do you want to know?
That didn't sound good. I was hoping it was a good time. People in the finals seemed excited, at least.
So here was the fundamental problem with Melee at Worlds this year. In Joust, and this is only for day 1, 1A and 1B. Day 2 got nothing on this front. Day 1A and 1B, you got $10 for 10 tickets for playing in Joust. Round 1, everyone gets 10 tickets. Then the winner of each game gets 10 more tickets. That's it. So if you go undefeated, if you are the King of Swiss So, Matt Lay, on your day, you got 70 tickets. If you play Melee...
I guess I misunderstood. I thought you said you get 10 for showing up and an additional 10 for winning. So you, the winner would get 20 each round?
So if you win... No. You only got 10 that first round.
No.
10 for showing
up. So you had $10 for playing on the day.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Correct. Everybody gets 10.
Gotcha.
Even if you don't win a single game,
I thought it was
10.
So Matt got 70.
Sit down at the table. Gotcha.
No. So an average of 5 tickets per player each round. If you max out, if you're Matt Lay, you got 70 tickets on the day. You got nothing for day 2. Doesn't matter how you did, how far you got nothing. In Melee, first place got 40, second 30, third 20, and last got 10. So an average of 25 tickets per person. So you finished Joust, you have a day off, either before or after, and you are starved for tickets. But you're in this hall looking over at this sweet prize wall, and you can't afford jack shit because you've only got 40 tickets in your pocket, and a playset of these new alt-art characters is 50. So now you have to go – if you just sit down at a Melee table, you get the 10 you need. So people are playing not to win but to get tickets. So winning, yes, but through tickets. So you see at day 1 saw a ton of ladies decks, ladies combo, because – the restricted list on Melee side is not caught up to Joust. Ladies is everywhere. Everyone has a miserable time, and they lucked into packing answers to stop them. So now ladies players are sad because if you're at a table with someone who does have an answer, the whole table is not going to gang up with you and beat you into the dirt. So you're going to get 10 tickets and do nothing. Or you're someone playing a Melee, like the table next to me round 1, this is on day 2, after we know ladies is a thing. So everyone's packing heat to shut down combo. The table next to me isn't equipped to deal with it. They literally had to beg him to let them go a second round so they could at least figure out, get a couple power and figure out positions before he auto won. Like, they begged for mercy from him to play the game. And there was a lot of that. And there was a lot of ties because people weren't, again, playing. They don't want the points. A tie in Melee is awful because you round down a spot.
Right.
But FFG said if you tied, we're going to round up for tickets.
Oh, gotcha. So should have kept that consistent.
Through deal making, I had a tie for second and a tie for third, which was awesome because I got tickets, but bad for scoring because I round down.
Gotcha.
But people would negotiate and work things out, and they're like, all right, well, I'll let you win if you help me tie with this guy. The dude's like, okay, cool. So he knocks me down a peg so that I tie with him at second. So he's going to get an extra 10 tickets, and then he king makes player number 3. It's like, well, this is fun, right? No, false. So the format led to a lot of really cruddy decisions. Now, things I did like, a table next to me said, hey, let's agree right now before all this that we will give 20 tickets? 20, 60. Yeah. Everyone got 20 tickets, and the winner got 40. And we were just going to even it out. We're going to play to win and do this legit. And they were like, sure, let's do it. And that table looked like they had a lot of fun. Played a good game. They all enjoyed it. Everyone walks away. A lot of people were there not because they liked Melee. They didn't have real Melee decks built. It was just, I'm here for the tickets. And that kind of killed it. It made it feel like a slog.
That's...
So FFG can learn from that by giving actual legit tickets to Melee. I mean, the guys who are at this final table should have been showered in tickets. Tyler, at top 32, should have way more tickets than me. But instead, he has, 50 tickets? And in Melee, I got 40, 30, 30, 120 from Melee alone. That doesn't make any sense. That's dumb.
And what ended up happening on top of that was they created this like black market of ticket sales where you have people peddling tickets to the other players who are playing in Joust so they can get enough to get the stuff that they're wanting, even though they're over here winning and doing what, you know, the goal of the day is to perform well in these things, and it comes down to who's got the most money to spend to buy the promos. And at the end of the day, the money isn't even going back to FFG. It's going to the other players who are playing over here in the Melee event. So it doesn't even make sense from a business standpoint for them to be doing it that way. All they're doing is benefiting the people who brought all the cash with them.
Oh, yeah. That's a tough one. I mean, I can definitely agree that if you're going to do tickets, that you should be kind of balancing out the like effective rate of return between the events, and that you should be, you know, skewing toward rewarding the people that do well a lot harder. As for whether they should be using the ticket system, I don't know. I'm torn on that. That's a fair point about the black market sort of thing, but on the other hand, like, if they just had, you know, like nationals or whatever, if they just had a promo that they handed to every person at that round, like, it's not like people that want more copies of those aren't still going to be paying someone else, you know, for their copy, which is effectively what tickets do with just an extra step in the middle. So I don't know. I definitely know I don't want to eliminate like promo cards and specialty items and stuff, because like I like swag. I like, you know, some of that stuff looks really awesome. Some of the downsides of the collectible stuff, like, I just guess I kind of accept to go along with that.
Now, I will say,
sure, and I would agree with that to an extent. I think the biggest issue I have with it from my perspective, looking at how they did it at Gen Con, how they did it at Worlds, is, you know, like in Gen Con, I didn't even have an opportunity to win a playset of the promos that they have. I didn't, for winning Gen Con, I got the same amount of Ashes that everyone else got. I didn't even get a house card. I had to go back the next day and play in the draft to get a house card. So it just doesn't make sense to me from a overall standpoint of how they allocate the prize pool. And I don't know if that's intentional or just oversight on their part, like, or what it is. But it just,
they need,
you know,
to be watching that scale to make sure it spreads correctly.
Exactly.
Yeah, I should not have been the big swag winner out of, you know, rings and the three Quincy guys who all go 32, 16, 8. Like, Shannon's jealous of he just was a top 10 in the world player, and he's jealous of the hardware that I bring home. I will say, though, that I think that there's easy fixes to the prize wall, like the weirdness there, you know, right? So, like, let's say, like you said, what if everyone got 10 tickets each round just for participating? I mean, same thing as Melee, right? You sit down, you're going to get minimum 10. Why don't you get minimum 10 for each round you play? and then the winner gets 10 more. That would take it to an average of 15 a player, which is, you know, still better than 5. And I think that would make things a little more fair. I'm not saying throw them out or like drop the prices to crazy small things, but, you know, I think there are ways to bridge. People should feel good when they're done with your main event, not rushing off to do side events in hopes of getting the prizes they want. I love the prize wall concept; is great. You get the things you actually want and care about, but I think the prize distribution of those tickets could re-examine in a better way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think you're right. I think that's the best way to do it, and you don't have people complaining about, oh, I didn't get what I wanted, or the prize support this year wasn't the one card I thought it should be. Instead, they get the option to pick and choose what they want, and I think there was definitely enough variety to make any player who was there feel like they got something they wanted. I think the only downside is you want to make sure the people who are spending the time and money and traveling the hundreds or thousands of miles to come play in this event, that they're there and they're going to feel appreciated. And you know, FFG is doing their part to make sure that, that's the case so we can continue to have these events and continue to support our
community. I will say to their credit that...
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's a fine line to walk.
I will say...
I was just going to say...
I will say to their credit, I thought the prizes themselves were all really good. The new, like, plastic see-through Wars to Come agenda is super cool. The alt-art characters are great. Having prizes from previous years in case you missed something was great. Like, the prizes themselves, I thought, were a step in the right direction. I thought were really good for the most part. Just the prizes seemed a touch high, and the ways in which you got tickets were a little disappointing. That's all. Those are easily fixable things.
Absolutely. And to kind of build on that, I would like to say everybody I ran into there was very helpful, very friendly and kind, and I think the staff there did a good job of putting on a good event. I don't think there were any dramatic issues of anything I can remember on the Joust side or anything like that. I think they'd put on a pretty good event overall too, so give them credit for that.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I think it's my line to walk, balancing to make sure that everybody feels like they got something worthwhile out of the day, even if they didn't, you know, come out and win the world championship or something, since nobody's winning, you know, a living wage's worth of money out of any of the Game of Thrones tournaments like you might in other card games. So, you know, for the most part, I do like what they do. Just kind of massage the numbers to kind of build yourself a, I guess you need like an inverted pyramid of prize support here so that it scales nicely. Props and slops. Yeah. I was gonna
kick it off with
go for it.
I guess it'll be out for a week at this point, but last season of House of Cards. I like when shows finish. So I'm excited to get the stunning conclusion to the Underwood storyline. I don't watch a lot of TV, but that's a good one I've really enjoyed, so excited to see how that wraps up.
Along that same line, Haunting a Hill House on Netflix. Watch it. It's awesome if you're into the creepy, freaky, scary shows. That one was excellent.
Oh, I need to check that out. Loved I haven't it. Yet. Well, I'm going to throw out a three-part prop to the Game of Thrones champs I'm aware of from the weekend. So to Leonard, to Jesse, and I hear tell that Kyle won Shots for Plots, and I very much apologize that somehow in the shuffle I missed who won Kingsmoot. Did you guys catch
who saw that? Won Kingsmoot? I think Leonard did. Won a Kingsmoot round on turn one, but that was all I saw.
I saw that. That was the closest I saw. So, fingers crossed, he went on to also win the Kingsmoot tournament at large. But I'm sure I would have heard about that. So, regardless, props to all of our champs.
And along that same line, I would give a shout out to my meta mates for helping me develop the decks we ended up bringing and You know, top
yeah,
eight.
Yeah, thanks for Tyler
top 16
for
finish on top
driving
of my,
my hobo ass up to
shout out
Minnesota.
To Robert Mixer.
I appreciated the free ride and the Quincy generosity. I am better than Jeff.
Oh, no. Ouch. Is he going to be
you're
listening to this?
Jeff, right?
Jeff's don't work. Okay. His attention span faded out hours ago.
Probably not. We're just kidding. We're kidding.
Man, we haven't even been going for hours. The actual
that's
like,
the mystique of Jeff.
The show at this point is
Jeff
like
transcends
hour
logic. He's so bad at things. It's like when Superman goes around the Earth and time goes backwards. Jeff has already failed at listening to this, and it's not out yet. I will slop a. Cold weather is finally here. I believe snow is in the forecast for the Midwest.
Pretty close to accurate.
So let's bundle up, everybody. Seems winter is coming a little
wow.
early this year.
I didn't know they were getting snow in Ohio. I'll admit we're not getting it down here in Missouri. So your statement does make me question whether I'm in
the
Midwest.
Oh, so many things make me question if I'm in the Midwest. But yeah, some of us are getting a dusting. I think a half inch or so,
exactly.
Maybe an inch. So not excited for that.
Nice.
Not excited.
Oh man, see, I'm getting excited. I'm getting ready for that. I don't want to, you know, just skip Thanksgiving and go straight into Christmas time. But I will be excited.
Comics. Don't you do that to me.
Along that note, I will
I'm
slop anyone who has their Christmas decorations up.
I mean, in Kyle's
already.
Defense, he left for a weekend trip.
Specifically,
suddenly,
people who might
you know,
be on this podcast.
All this
right
stuff
now.
Happened while he was gone. He didn't have a hand in the decoration.
Christmas
yeah,
happens to me. I don't happen to Christmas.
He had no part of it.
Oh, man. Well, semi-related, actually, to that note, because it deals with Kyle's abode. I know he's got a big event coming up later, early in 2019, which I'll let him prop in a minute. But before that, I'm going to prop that I know he's doing an extra special whiskey tasting event there and is going to be doing that with all the Game of Thrones whiskeys or scotches, I suppose they are, right? Regardless, I got the Lannister one for myself, a Lagavulin 9, which I have been drinking during this podcast. And, you know, I'm not usually that big on things this smoky and peaty, definitely neat. It was a bit much for me, but now that my two ice cubes have melted in it, it's really got some like honey notes coming out. Like I think I can kind of root for it. So there you go. Maybe I'll just randomly pop open Game of Thrones scotches between now and then and give you guys a quick little preview before the actual event.
I'm pretty excited for those.
Yeah, I think they're going to be good. So what is this event that I'm dancing around, Kyle? Just take it away.
Oh yeah, so Ireworlds 2018 happening in 2019. As I think the page says, if the Super Bowl can do it, so can I. The latest event added, as Will said, he was a super bro this weekend and ran into his local booze store and got all of the Thrones-themed scotches that just released. It's a real limited run, but a bunch of different distilleries came together and they did Thrones-inspired whiskeys for different houses. So we're going to sell tickets to that and do like a flight and get try them all. Pretty much an excuse for us all to sit in my basement and get hella drunk on classy booze. So no one can judge you, which is nice, which is very nice. So one of many side events we look to be adding in the coming days, I think we should finally have some swag finalized. So be teasing some house card art, some t-shirt art, some other swag. So look forward to that. I believe both of our previous reigning champions have committed to coming, so Chris Schoenthal and Sandy Barnabas should be in attendance. A special surprise for them and everyone else as participation prize. Yeah, the things are coming along. I know with the holidays it's tough to make plans and it's easy to forget, but if you book now, you do get cheaper tickets thanks to our early bird special. So try and do that. Save yourself some money. Get an early spot. We kind of do first come, first serves on beds. So if you want a bedroom, there are still some available. Try to book that. Spouses are super welcome. There's a lot to do in Muscatine. People had a lot of fun playing Not Thrones things. Matt, who was on here earlier, got so drunk the night before that he slipped through first round of Swiss and decided just to play board games in the basement and continue getting drunk, which he had a hell of a time and really loved it, and so can you. So if you have people in your group that aren't necessarily crazy about Thrones, bring them anyways. They can have a great time. Life will be good. Yeah, I think that's it for this week's Iowa
Where
World's
can they
prop,
actually go to register?
Hear more news in 2 weeks. www.ioworlds.com. Check it out. Tell me what you think. If you have any questions or concerns, feel free to, you know, message us here at the White Book, and we'll get it passed on to me, and I can get back with you and figure it all out.
Well, hopefully none of those questions put us in the danger zone.
Ooh.
Definitely.
Danger zone.
This chapter, White Book.